Take a listen to this. It's from March 14th, 1965. It's Alabama Governor George Wallace on the CBS News program Face the Nation with Nelson Benton. The discussion is about the beating of activists attempting to march from Selma to Montgomery.
Governor, you referred to Philadelphia and to New York as riots. You think that the situation that existed on this side of the Edmund Pettus Bridge on Sunday was a riot? The Negroes were standing in a line waiting and asking to have a word with your troopers,
sir. Mr. Benton, and I want to say again that my orders have always been to use a minimum amount of force. No force if necessary. For goodness sakes, don't let anybody get hurt. I've said that over and over and over. That's all.
Was the amount of force used last Sunday the minimum required?
Was it the minimum required? That matter at the present time, as a result of the charges of police brutality, is under investigation, but I'm not going to be stampeded or blackjacked, as Mr. Johnson said, into making any accusations against the police because some outside agitators themselves have accused us of police brutality.
Yeah, that was Alabama Governor George Wallace in 1965 on the CBS News program Face the Nation, and what he was referring to was what would come to be known as Bloody Sunday at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and it was captured on television as state troopers beat marchers who were demonstrating for voting rights. Well, it's been 50 years since then, and this weekend, thousands are expected in Selma again. They will reenact the Selma to Montgomery Civil Rights March, Rose.
And Dennis, a motorcycle brigade will escort 6 buses from Atlanta to Selma, and on those buses, the Reverend Timothy McDonald is a former SCLC staffer and pastor of Iconium Baptist Church. He'll also give the keynote at Shiloh Baptist Church in Selma for the Voter Empowerment Collaborative Delegation. And also making that trip will be Miss Shanari Ferris and her 16-year-old son, Danny. They're all in our Closer Look studios. Thank you all for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Reverend McDonald, I'm going to start with you. You know, Sunday's event is much more than just commemorating the march. But voter empowerment is still on your mind and a lot of other people. It's still the issue. That's a big issue in this nation.
The great equalizer in our democratic process is the right to vote. And the 50th anniversary of Selma is quite different than many of the previous anniversaries. So we're extremely excited about going down this year. As we know, there's a lot of voter suppression going on around the nation. The Supreme Court virtually gutted the voting rights bill. We still don't have a good bill in the Congress, and so we have a lot of work to do, and Selma is critical.
When you talk about and when you think about all that's been sacrificed to bring awareness about the equality when it comes for voting rights, when you think about all that's been sacrificed, but still, African Americans have the lowest percentage of voter turnout on Election Day. So there's still something that needs to be done within the African-American community. Would you admit?
Well, actually, in the last presidential election,
that was the highest ever.
It was the highest ever, and it was the first time in the history that African-Americans had preceded any other group. Yes, in certain areas there is low turnout, but it depends on if you have the right kind of candidate, if you have the right kind of issues. African-Americans have always voted not along party lines, as a lot of people think, but they vote their interest, they vote the candidate that they think best represents them. And when you have a good candidate, when you have issues that are critical, African-Americans turn out. And so what we've seen, because they have turned out, is voter suppression laws. Even right now, there's debate, particularly in the South, of eliminating early voting, if not at the very least, shortening early voting. If it was not effective, then why would they be going through all of these procedures and maneuverings to try to suppress the vote?
And when you say they, are you particularly talking about the Republican Party?
It's not just the Republican Party. Certainly they are key in that, because most African Americans are registered Democrats. But again, there are African Americans who have crossed lines and voted if that person represents their interests. But yeah, it is the religious right. It is those who are in power who want to stay in power and see that the way to do that is to suppress the vote.
Well, Reverend McDonald, let me turn the voter turnout figures that you just talked about around. Wouldn't that be an argument, and some Republican leaders have indeed made that argument, that if the turnout is so great, doesn't that prove that the new laws really don't suppress the vote? That there is that African Americans are voting just like everyone else, and they have the same opportunities that everybody else has to vote.
Sounds like the exact same thing that George Wallace said 50 years ago, and why they went through so much to try to make sure that blacks did not vote. It's clear that around this country, there is voter suppression, and particularly of the African-American vote and the poor vote. So we have to make sure that Selma looms large on its 50th birthday celebration.
But let's take the early voting measures that are being talked about in the legislature right now. Would those have any disproportionate effect on African-Americans as a voting group, or would everyone simply be affected? And aren't we seeing with early voting that it's the same people voting, they just find different times to vote?
See, there's a prior question. Why do we even vote on Tuesday anyway, when most people are working, particularly African Americans are working? In most other countries where they're really promoting voting, it's more than one day, it's on the weekends, and it's made easier. In this country, the fact is, we're making voting more difficult. We're making it harder. I mean, right now in this Congress, there is debate, and people are trying to stop Congressman John Lewis and the voting rights bill that he's introducing. So we say we're promoting democracy around the world, and yet we're suppressing democracy right here at home.
The attempts to open the polls on Sundays, which was, there were some districts here in the Atlanta area, mm-hmm. yep. which brought out a fairly significant percentage of African Americans, but then there was sort of pushback that was geared toward Democrats and trying to get more African Americans. And the other argument is that, well, no matter, it wasn't just voting for African Americans on Sunday, it was whoever wanted to come out and vote.
And the same polls were open in northern white districts as were open in southern black districts. It wasn't any advantageous maneuver for African Americans to be able to vote on Sunday.
Perhaps that should be national then.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that voting should be allowed on the weekends. We should be able to vote more than on Tuesday. That's why absentee voting is so critical. The Republican Party of the right has used absentee voting as one of their main mechanisms to turn out their vote. Now African Americans are becoming more wise about absentee voting. We're beginning to utilize it. And when you couple that with early voting, one person, one vote is the greatest way to assure democracy in our country.
Real quickly, before we get to Ms. Ferris and to Danny, wanted to ask you what part of the reason it seems that the voting or key portions of the Voting Rights Act were struck down was because it applied to particular parts of the country. And the argument was, look, now the South is no better or worse than any other part of the country. Would you agree with that?
Oh, no. We still live in the Bible Belt. Don't kid yourself. The Bible Belt is very real. And if you look at the southern states, particularly if you look at now who controls the southern states, Georgia notwithstanding, every branch of our government is now controlled by the Republican Party, in my opinion, by the religious right. And that is not only true for Georgia, that's true of other southern states. So the Bible Belt is real. And in the South, where slavery kind of had its genesis, there is still that kind of mentality as it relates to African Americans. And we have to change that. And I believe Selma helps us to change that. One person, one vote makes democracy, democracy for all.
Well, let's shift gears here and talk about the importance of Selma and the next generation. Shanari Ferris is in our Closer Look studio with her son, Danny. And Shanari, you go back every year to Selma around this time. Is that true?
We do. We go every year. We go every year to commemorate Bloody Sunday. It's really, really passionate to us, to our organization, the Voter Empowerment Collaborative, as well as Future Voters of America.
And Danny's been going since he was an infant. Is that true?
That's true. All my children have been going since they were very young.
What have you told them throughout their growing up about the importance of Selma and what it means?
Selma, it means so much to us because they know how hard it has been for African Americans to reach this milestone, just to have the right to vote. And with this 50th year anniversary, it's just, you have to go. 50 years ago, the voting rights, we pushed and we worked hard to to get the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And we're here again with the same issue, just trying to get the Voting Rights Amendment Act of H.R. 885 passed again. So that's really, you know, the big issue this year. That's why it's so important to us this year. But it's really because our forefathers have, they were beaten at the on the bridge, and they were, you know, it's just what they had to go through just to get this Voting Rights Act passed. So it's important that my children know, and as well as, you know, people in general know that if you don't go, or if you don't know, you can find yourself where we've already been before.
I want to address this question now to Danny. Danny, you're 16 years old, and I know you've seen clips, and I know you've seen footage of what happened on that bloody Sunday. Tell me your thoughts when you see images like that.
It kind of hurts my heart to see it, and a kind of pride comes with it to see that a race can come from so low and over so much discrimination. And what was so special about it is that it was nonviolence, even though violence was towards us, mm-hmm. you know. And it gives me a certain pride in my race that we can come from violence being put on us with nonviolence and come up. That we don't have to fight or be prove ourselves as animals to get what we deserve and get our rights.
You're 16 now, and you'll be able to vote in a couple of years now. So you're understanding the importance of the empowerment of your vote.
Yes, ma'am. I'm actually the president of Future Voters of America. It's under VEC, Voter Empowerment Collaborative, and what we do, we teach 7 through 17-year-olds the importance of voting and information about voting, so when they get to that age of 18, they know how to do it, and they're aware of the restrictions that's out there.
Yeah, Danny, that was where I was going too. Is are you planning to vote when you get to the age where you can, and are you also looking at some of the rules or restrictions depending on which side of the fence one is on for this, like ID and so forth? Do you think for your generation that those rules are as hard as they certainly have been for some older folks who might not have had an ID or a driver's license or something like that?
Yeah, I think the restrictions could kind of get worse if we don't do what we need to do right now, because back then in 1965 and before the barriers and the voting disenfranchisement, it was so broad that you could easily see it, but now it's kind of hidden where you can't see it.
But does your generation are you more likely to have an ID, and are your friends more likely to have an ID than, say, some of the older folks who may never have learned to drive, for instance, in some of the poor and disadvantaged communities?
Oh, yes, sir, most definitely.
So then the argument, I think, from some of the Republican state officials here would be, okay, these conditions, especially now, are not really that restrictive for voters. How would you respond to that?
I would say that it all goes back to education and how much you know about voting. That's why I think it's so important that we're educating our young people to know how to be aware of the restrictions. So I think it's just a knowledge. I don't think they're trying to get over on like the black race per se, just the whole uneducated voters and take advantage of that. So that's why we had to educate ourselves.
Reverend McDonald, when you hear a young person like Danny talk about the importance of education, you got a big smile on your face there.
I am so encouraged because when you think about it, 50 years ago, those who led that movement, they were young people. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were in their teens, in their early 20s, and they were willing to put their lives on the line. You know, something is wrong when you can't use your college ID, but you can use your gun license to vote. In terms of if something is seriously wrong with that.
Let's talk about mobilization here, because we know during the Civil Rights Movement, there was strategy, there was unity. I mean, there was some little tension, but there was a broad sense of this is our strategy, and you were able to mobilize in different states. That's changed, it seems like, because you have different groups. I mean, we've had two different groups here in this studio who disagreed about strategy but still wanted the same end result as it relates to civil rights.
I think we have to keep our eyes on the goal. Even the fact that Dr. King was able to have a Jesse Jackson, a Andy Young, a Hosea Williams, a James Bell, all of them in the same room and they all work together is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. There is no one route. We just have one goal. There are many streets and many roads that lead to voter empowerment, and kind of state by state, because we don't have a national voting anymore. States are kind of doing their own thing and trying to disenfranchise individuals from voting. And it is becoming more of a class struggle now than a race struggle. They just don't want poor folk to vote because there are more poor people than there are rich people. And if the poor people are actually one person, one vote, that empowers the poor, which means blacks and Hispanics and other minorities.
Rural communities.
Yeah, rural communities. And one of the other strategy they're trying to use now is the reducing of precincts, which will definitely impact. You mentioned rural communities and made the bail go off. They're trying now to reduce precincts in states so that it makes it more difficult. So not only voter ID bills, not only trying to cut back on early voting, but they want, which we've been fighting for the last three decades, is to expand precincts so that makes it easier and more accessible to vote. Now they want to really impact rural America by lessening the precinct and making it more difficult to vote.
Reverend McDonald and Danny, because you represent different generations, I want to, in a way, come back to where we started, because we're talking about the 50th anniversary of Selma. And Reverend McDonald, I'll start with you, and then Danny, you as well. What was it about Selma that made it so special? I mean, we had all sorts of incidents all over the country that were very similar to Selma, but what was it about that 50 years ago that made it such a turning
point? Bull Connor. You said Bull Connor is what made Selma work. Media was just coming out. Television was just coming into the country and going into the living rooms of Americans. And they had to have that visual to motivate the country. And Bull Connor gave us that visual.
So it was
and George Wallace as well, to be honest with you.
So it was the convergence of people, media,
yes,
and the moment.
Yeah, I've really been thinking about writing a paper about the role of media and the movement, even as some of my doctoral aspirations. I don't think that we really looked at the impact and the role that media played in the civil rights movement, particularly in Selma and getting and acquiring the voting rights.
And Danny, real quickly, same question for you, because for you, this is studying. What was it? There were marches. There were police incidents with civil rights workers throughout the history of the movement, but Selma was a big turning point. Why do you think that was?
Just because it was so blatant in that it was the media and everybody could see it, and it's just it opened eyes of not only the African American race but white people, but Caucasian people too. But at the same, so everybody could see the hatred that was going on, and it was just a boost for the nation, actually, for the whole nation, just not a race, just the whole nation and minorities.
Shaneri, I want to speak to you for a second, because I want to also, there's another element in all this when we talk about the civil rights movement, and then we here in 2015, that is the plight of the African-American young male as it relates to tensions with the authorities. Your son is 16 years old. You look at what happened in Ferguson and other areas around the country. Have you, and we've heard about this talk that African-American parents have to have with their sons. Have you had to have that talk with Danny?
Not at all. Not at all. Danny is he's a straightforward person. He's a no-nonsense kind of gentleman. He's just a great young man. He really is. So, I'm blessed to not to have that talk with him. But you brought up Ferguson, and I just wanted to comment that, you know, I think one of the issues in Ferguson is, you know, what we're talking about and why we're here today is just talking about the Voting Rights Act and, getting the right people in office. And I think that is one of the problems that that Ferguson has. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have the right people in office,
and that's,
you know, people not getting out to vote like they should. to put the right people in.
And that's a fair representation of that African-American community. I am from St. Louis, and I played basketball in Ferguson, rode my bike through Ferguson, know the community very well. But you're talking about having fair representation on the political side that represents everyone in the community.
That's correct.
When you all are in, and Reverend McDonald, you can pick it up, or Shanari, when you all are in Selma this weekend and you're going to network with other people too, it doesn't just stop after the weekend's events are over. Are you hoping that this network continues so that you'll have some year-round conversation and dialogue with not only just people in Selma, but people here in Atlanta to keep your movement, to keep things going in terms of what you want to see happen for the community?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm also the national head of an organization called the African American Ministers in Action, a People for the American Way. And since 1997, we've been going all across the country doing voter education and voter empowerment. Voting occurs every year. It's our message. It's not just presidential elections. Voting occurs from the local level, state, and the national level, and it occurs, you know, every year. And we got to make sure that people are engaged every year. So yes, we're going to seize on the Selma moment, but as soon as we finish crossing that bridge, we're getting ready for November the 3rd. I mean, local elections where we elected people who are supposed to be representing us. The problem in Ferguson, that's the local elections.
Sure.
That they did not elect the right type of people in an area that is majority African Americans. And so now we're in Ferguson organizing people, trying to identify candidates, educating them on the issues, and making sure that they are empowered and that there are not these kinds of laws and rules of when you can vote and early voting and ID that will discourage, because that's the power structure wants to do, is discourage voters from voting.
Reverend McDonald, I want to ask you, because I know we're short on time here, you keep hearing this term about post-racial, and are we living in a post-racial society? I'm going to throw that question to you.
We are nowhere near a post-racial society. It's a great idea. It's a great vision to keep before us, but we got a lot of work to do.
Shanari, what do you think?
I agree. Mm-hmm. We still have a lot of work to do. We have a long way to go.
Danny, what do you think? Are we living in a post-racial society where, you know, the questions are, racism is not as big as it used to be? What do you think?
No, I think we can get there, but I don't think, not yet.
Okay.
Danny, let me follow up with you. Since it's your generation that is going to be the next to take on that job, where would you like to start in achieving that goal?
I think we should get to a point where we're not so separate. You know, we should get to a point where we should all just be together, and everything shouldn't just be about race.
Because there are a lot of places, you mentioned it, with separate housing, for instance. Even though the laws say one thing, people tend to be in different places. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Like, for example, even my school down in Douglasville, it's speculation that it was, the schools were separated by race, but it was by income. And when you deal with income, it kind of bears back to race.
And that's where you'd like to begin?
Yes, sir. I want to make sure we're all educated and make sure that we know what's going on.
Danny, Shanari, Reverend McDonald, thank you all so much for coming in and taking the time. We appreciate it.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You're listening to A Closer Look. This is Rose Scott alongside Dennis O'Hara. Coming up next, we're going to tell you about the cyclo-